The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, it's time for Rick Kirby, two-fisted private detective, and his adventures around the world. The worlds of Gotham Knights are on their way, but the rest of the DCEU may be later than we think. Plus, Slumber, Ants, and Speed, which I think stars Raquel Welch, leading us inexorably down a slippery slope to the Major Spoilers podcast, which is over the top, beside the point, above the fray, and it's on the air.
Welcome to issue 968 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Of course, Rodrigo is here. Matthew is here. Also, Scott Johnson joining us once again on the Major Spoilers podcast. Scott, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to hang out with you boys tonight.
Oh, well, we're very excited to have you here. And we had a lot of discussions about things that we were reading, watching, or playing. You can go hear that in the Major Spoilers pre-show that you get with your Patreon subscription, patreon.com/Major Spoilers. Let's just jump right into the news. Good news, everyone. Oh, that's how I'd love to start a news segment with good news, everyone. WB Games has finally announced a release date for the Gotham Knights video game. The game features Nightwing, Batgirl, Robin, and the Red Hood as they try to restore justice to Gotham City following the death of Batman. Spoiler. The heroes will come into conflict with the Court of Owls and their brainwashed assassins called the Talons. Gotham Knights arrives on October 25th, 2022. Now, this is not a Rocksteady game, Scott. This is WB Games doing this, right? So this is not like the other.
Yeah, Batman this is. Stuff. So there is some good about this. If you liked Batman Origins, which was a weird version of the Arkham style game that was wedged in between Arkham Asylum and Arkham City, or maybe in between City and Arkham Knight, I can't remember, but it was one of those sandwiched in there. Another developer did it. And it wasn't as well received or well reviewed overall as the other Arkham games, but it did do some interesting stuff diving into early Batman time, which is a good time, right now for that sort of thing, I suppose. We're all into early Batman these days. And it's good. It's not great like those other games. Rocksteady's working on a Suicide Squad game, and everyone's pretty stoked about that. I don't even think we have a date on that yet, but I'm actually pretty optimistic about this. This is a good developer. They're sturdy. They've made other fine quality games in the meantime. They've had enough experience with these properties. I think it could be good. So I remain on the happy side of the fence for this one.
I've seen a few of the trailers and a few of the pre-programmed gameplays that they send out to everybody. And it looks like a pretty fun game, especially when you get into the, the Death of Batman storyline with, Under the Hood. Is that the name of it, Matthew? The Under the Hood storyline? Or the Battle for the Cowl, sorry.
Battle for the Cowl would be the one where everybody was going to be.
Yeah, so you get a little bit of that. You get the Court of Owls in there. So this could be some good times. Maybe I will check it out October 25th. I don't know, Rodrigo. Are you going to get this game or no?
I think I'm going to see how it's received, and then I might check it out.
Okay. All right. Rodrigo, why don't you tell us about Gotham Knights?
All right. So Gotham Knights, the CW has added three more to the cast of Gotham Knights, the show. Olivia Rose Keegan, Navia Robinson, and Oscar Morgan will join Fallon Smith, I think, and Tyler DiChiara in the series. The television series takes place in the wake of Bruce Wayne's murder,
spoilers,
which is different than the game we were just talking about where Batman dies. It's something else. Here's how the CW describes the series. Quote, his rebellious adopted son forges an unlikely alliance with the children of Batman's enemies when they're all framed for killing the Caped Crusader. And as the city's most wanted criminals, this renegade band of misfits must fight to clear their names. But in a Gotham with no Dark Knight to protect it, the city descends into the most dangerous it's ever been. However, Hope comes from the most unexpected of places, as this team of mismatched fugitives will become its next generation of saviors, known as the Gotham Knights, unquote.
How did that... I guess Stargirl is doing okay, right? With all the kids of the villains, yeah, and the kids of the heroes.
There's a lot to unpack here.
I know, right?
Definitely. Yeah, I was like, okay. So, yeah, this will be like the same thing. Batwing or Nightwing, or, you know, maybe Batwing. You know, Nightwing and Batgirl and Son O' Demon, like, doing stuff. But then it turns out, no, he's going to turn out with the penguin chick.
The son of the penguin.
And the
daughter of the Riddler. And
the flamingette.
Yeah.
doctorate student pig. So that we'll see how that goes. You guys remember that that thing that came out that at some point somebody commissioned this thing that was like Gotham High?
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly
like it looked cool, but it seemed terrible. And this is kind of another thing where I'm like, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, it is the CW, so it's
high school Batman. I don't
know. It's the CW, so expect a lot of pretty people.
Gorgeous.
Who did Fox did Got Ham, so it's probably not going to be as dark as Got Ham. Scott, do you watch any of the CW DC shows?
No, I mean, I've caught some here and there. My biggest problem with the CW stuff was that it just ended up being a lot of pretty people talking about stuff I don't care about most of the time. And so when I was trying to enjoy, say, I don't know, Arrow, I was kind of into Arrow for a while. Arrow was one part kind of cool and another part kind of boring and you know, soap opera-y in a way that it wasn't really grabbing me. So not to knock anyone else's enjoyment of that sort of thing, but I just could never get into it. But everything they've put out on even prior to HBO Max and that whole deal, but even when they were putting it on DC Infinite, all of that stuff I've loved.
Titans and Doom Patrol.
It's just a little grittier and less... I don't know, less tailored to whatever the CW tailors itself to. I wish I could take that stuff more seriously, but it's just not my jam.
Understandable. I'm not sure I'm going to be into this. I may watch the first episode, but I have a feeling it's going to be a hard pass right after that.
Kind of feel like that. You know, I fell away from Batwoman, and I don't necessarily feel like I've missed it because every time I go back, you know, we have that same problem. And Steven and I have been complaining on Flashback for a couple of years now that characters are having to relearn the same lessons over and over for these young adult audiences. And the CW is like, yep, we're gonna really focus in on this family drama. And I'm like, well, yeah, but our main character is the super speedster. Having these superpowers could really, you know, take care of a lot of these. If he just open his eyes, he could take care of a lot of these problems and we wouldn't have to keep having the same discussion over and over and over. But I'm not bitter.
All right, Matthew, wrap up our news segment, please.
And speaking tangentially of the Flash, who is always late, this is canonical back to 1954. Last week, Warner Brothers once again announced that all of the DC Universe movies have once again been pushed back in sort of a domino effect. Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom has now been moved to March 17th, 2023, moving The Flash back to June 23rd, 2023, making almost 10 years since Ezra Pound was chosen for the role. But do not worry, you will still be getting our DC movies in 2022. Black Adam is scheduled to arrive October 21st of this year. Super Pets, the crypto movie will be taking Black Adam's original slot on July 29th, 2022, and Shazam! Fury of the Gods, a.k.a. Shazam! 2, has been moved up to December 12th of this year.
So I'm forward to Shazam! I know my youngest is looking forward to Shazam! He loves that movie. When we went to go see it together, it was a great bonding moment for us. Every time we sit down and it pops up, he's like, Dad, I love this movie so much. I'm like, oh, man, then we are going to have to go see when Shazam dresses up as a dog and goes to the comic book convention and has to fight all the other people in animal costumes.
Sounds amazing. I never saw that movie. I feel bad that I haven't.
Oh, man, you need to sit down and watch it. Now, I will say it's got a lot of fun. It's aimed towards kids, but there's some scary, dark moments in the first Shazam movie. Like, it gets dark, like
that's cool.
Patricide.
Eyes being ripped out on the panel.
Yeah.
Frederick Wortham is spinning in his grave. So
yeah.
I mean, granted, it's not Shazam doing that. It's not Billy Batson, but the bad guy is a bad guy. So there you go.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I think I need to finally just cave and watch it. I don't know why I put it off. Shazam for me as a kid, like you guys, was that horrible TV show. And so for me, it was like, I know it's not the same, and I know they're not doing that again.
Right.
But it was still hard for me to push that out of my head.
I really like Zachary Levi as Shazam. He's really good in that role. He's got the body for it. He's got the humor for it. I think he just does a really good job. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And I guess everybody else is excited for Super Pets. So I will go and see that as well. Super Pets. I won't see it. I'll have to wait till it comes out on HBO Max.
It's got Ace the Bat Hound in it, which
I know, right?
To hear a schnauzer going, I'm Batman.
No, he's like,
arf.
When I was a young boy, I was ripped from my parents and given up for adoption. That's
literally in the trailer.
Yeah, that's in the trailers it's like his parents aren't killed. He was taken away from them. So
isn't The Rock is Crypto or something, right?
Yep.
The Rock is Crypto. Kevin Hart is Ace and Keanu Reeves is Batman.
Okay.
Nice. Yep.
All right. I'm down with all that, actually.
That one you might be able to take your grandkid to, Scott.
Yeah. And it seems silly and, but also, I don't know. They should be silly. These pets of the DC pets are silly. That's the point. Yeah. So go all in and make it fun. But are we supposed to ask, is like The Rock, you know, is he double dipping here? He's supposed to be Black Adam. What's going on? Double dipping.
Maybe Black Adam writes fan fiction in his spare time and animates movies.
Who's the girl that plays Spider-Gwen? She did Spider-Gwen and she was Hawkeye, Kate Bishop. Steinfeld.
Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah, Haley Steinfeld. She's double dipping too. So
she is double dipping and she's awesome. And I'm fine with her double dipping. I don't
know
why.
And one could even argue that Chris Evans double dip playing both the Human Torch and Captain America.
It's almost like all of these movies are just casting the same handful of actors.
Weird.
It's really almost like the same 15 years we've had the same actors because no one is allowed to move past anything.
That's right.
That's right.
And dear listeners, we want your thoughts on all this stuff. You can join in the conversation about these stories and more over on our Discord server. There's a link in the show notes. Just click on it. It'll take you right to our Discord server. You can come in and join the hundreds of other people that are having discussions. And the best part is the Major Spoilers Discord server is absolutely free for you to join. So go check it out today. Let's see 100 more of you join this week. What are you waiting for?
Yeah.
Come on. Do it.
What's wrong with you?
Do it. Click on the link. Click on
it. You won't be cool if you don't do it.
Click on the link.
Peer pressure.
All right. Let us jump into some reviews. Scott, you have started an interesting trade paperback from Image Comics. What are you reading?
Well, I decided to try something that I had never heard before. I was in the mood for something kind of independent, just a little caped and cowled out at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spent so much time on the DC app lately that I just thought, well, this would be a nice change of pace. So started asking around in my community and I had somebody recommend a book that had apparently two volumes out. I don't think there's a volume three yet.
Right. Just
called
two.
Glitter Bomb, volume one and two. These are older, 27, not that old. It's 2017 was when the original volume came out. I'm guessing the issues came, you know, the year before that or something. But basically it's this story of a character who, is trying to revive her acting career while raising a child alone. And, in the process of doing so, I don't want to give too much away here, but they end up in, let's put it this way. They end up in the ocean, something gets into them. And now they're like a horrible, like tentacle creature that every once in a while, without her meaning to, kind of Hulk style, usually when she's upset or someone's made her mad or something, this huge, like, piercing tentacle will come ripping out of her mouth and tear people to shreds.
Oh, great.
Very, very violent. Yeah. I should give credit where it's due as far as who is.
Yeah. Jim Zub is the writer on this.
There it is.
He does a lot of the Dungeons and Dragons stuff now. And then, K. Michael Russell is the artist on this.
That's correct. Morissette and Dylan are involved in somehow. Maybe one's a letter. I'm not sure. Anyway, so far so good. I'm not super deep. I'm two issues in. And I'm going to keep going because I'm enjoying it, but it's really pulpy Hulk kind of story. and that's fine. I'm you know, excited to kind of see where it goes. And I like a you know, comic that decides that, you know, wants to get nice and violent. I don't know why. I don't know what I'm admitting to here, but I like violent comics, I guess. And this one is definitely one of those, but it's also an interesting journey so far. This woman is, you know, struggling with her identity, and as she ages out of the role she used to get in Hollywood and can't seem to be getting any more jobs. I just thought that was an interesting take for a character, and her trying to learn how to control this thing. Again, very David or Bruce Banner sort of, but she seems to be doing okay. And we're two issues in, so who knows where it goes? I still don't know the origin of this thing that's inside of her or part of her now.
Aliens.
But yeah, probably aliens, I assume. And they're ruthless if they are. Volume one's called Red Carpet. Like I said, I just started it, picked it up on Amazon Comixology, and so far so good.
So we give meatloaf ratings here, Scott. Five slices of meatloaf is the top. How would you rate? How many slices of meatloaf would you eat serve up for Glitter Bomb?
Thus far, I would give it. I'd give it three and three quarters of my meatloaf.
Okay. All right.
So far, so good. I really like Zub's writing. I always have.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this, you know, I'll just admit the premise is a little done before, like all premises, it feels like anyway, but his writing is unique in this case. And, you know, definitely not a comic for kids. If you're looking for something to watch with your 10-year-old, probably pass on this, but so far, you know, I'm getting kind of a boy's vibe out of it. I like that stuff. So this is kind of in that vein, and it's good. I like
it. Very cool. All right, Matthew, what do you got from Image Comics? Eric Larson's at it again.
Eric Larson.
But it's not Savage Dragon, right?
No, this is what? Ant.
How is that Ant. Possible? He's not just doing Savage Dragon. That's all he ever does.
Right? And that's the thing that's really strange about it, because the story of Ant actually begins way back in the far-flung year 2004, actually as not an Image comic, but as an independent comic. And Ant was a book made by a man named Mario Gulli. And I'm going to be honest with you. I was in a comic store at the time, and we bought a few issues of Ant, and they went to the same people who bought all of what we call the Bad Girl books. So Ant comics have traditionally been all about the main character having an incredibly zoftig figure, if you will. Specifically, what do you call that? Her pneumothorax near the back. But Mario never finished that series. And Eric Larson, apparently being a huge fan of it, actually purchased the character rights solely so he could actually read or be a part of the end of a series that he used to like. So he literally bought the series. He bought the character. He bought the rights from Mario Gulli. And the first two issues of Ant have been kind of establishing it in the world of Savage Dragon. Having read those original issues, I want to tell you something important about issue 3 that struck me halfway through. Some of this we've seen before, and not necessarily in a bad way. This is an attempt to take the three previous Ant miniseries, which, by the way, have incompatible premises. One is a little girl, like a schoolgirl, who dreams that she's a superhero, and the other is a very much grown-up supermodel woman who is a murderous superhero in her spare time. And so as this story progresses, we see that character dressed the same way, which is to say, yeah, very, very much a focus on Ant's body, which, again, you know, that's a thing that happens. It's an Eric Larson comic. And we see her get involved in a situation with a supervillain. But then, unlike the previous issues, she also ends up in the sewers fighting a villain of unknown portent, and then Spawn shows up. Because this is Image Comics, my friends, and the original seven Image guys had a shared universe. So Ant, who has already met the Savage Dragon, is now hanging out with Spawn. And what this allows them to do is to have Spawn, who's kind of the foundation of Image Comics, telling this girl, man, you're dangerous. You scare me. You just stabbed that guy in the heart without thinking or caring. And it's a really interesting approach. And as the issue ends, by the way, that's not a spoiler.
As the issue ends, there is a spoiler that I'm not necessarily going to go into, but Ant and Spawn have this moment of, you know, the superhero, we fought a little bit and now we fought beside each other and we're going to have that conversation at the end, but it's very much different than what I expect. And it kind of plays into those previous two series, and it's taking the tone of even Hannah, the main character, doesn't know what's real. And on that level, it's really, really interesting stuff. As far as if you're a fan of Savage Dragon, specifically the way he draws Malcolm's sister, who is Lightning of the Special Operations Strike Force, you'll probably find some similarities between Malcolm's sister, the current dragon's sister, and the main character of Ant. But that's also, you know, Eric Larson. I will say that he does go out of his way to change the style. This is not just the exact same as Savage Dragon. And I think that's the most interesting part, is watching this creator who's been drawing in this universe, those Savage Dragon books for, God, 30 years. I'm just going to crumble away into dust. And
is that really how old that is? 30?
Yeah. Savage Dragon, the first limited series, came out in 93. So next year will be the 30th anniversary.
That's crazy.
I know. And he's like,
happy anniversary, Savage Dragon.
He's like 280 issues in.
Yeah. And he's what, 95 now?
I think Eric is exactly my age, or maybe Steven's age, a little bit older than me. But
you mean Scott's age?
Yeah, my age too. Yeah.
I don't know how old Scott is. I don't
he's older than me.
I'm the big 5'2", yo. Not much older than you. But.
No, you're only like a couple of months older. So
Steven just likes being able to say that to somebody.
Yeah.
Because I've been saying that to him for 20 years. But
I know the feeling. I love it.
Age, yeah. Just a number.
That's right. And that number is really, really high. Yeah. But Ant number 3 surprised me in ways good and not quite as good. It did not surprise me in a way that was not necessarily good. I was still a little bugged by the amount of cheesecake and fan service.
I got it.
You got it?
Yeah, you were a little bugged.
You got that? Yeah, it's a thing.
It was good.
So, yeah, thanks. Thanks for pointing out my joke there.
Yeah. You're welcome, man. I wanted to make sure people laughed at it instead of just letting it go by.
I'm just going to soldier on, try not to get fired.
Soldier on like a soldier ant?
Exactly. Yes. Thank you, Rodrigo.
You go, queen.
You know what, Steven? You just keep droning and people will listen to me. Okay. So here's the deal. 3 slices of meatloaf. Ant-infested meatloaf sounds really, really good, doesn't it? 3 slices of meatloaf for Ant number 3. I'm still hanging in, yo. I think I'm going to keep following this book until they, you know, completely throw me. Or if, you know, they explain what's going on and I just plain hate it. But, you know, if you like Savage Dragon and you want something with a more feminine protagonist and maybe a little bit more blood and guts, God help us, because Savage Dragon
is all that. I've got a question, though.
57. Yes.
How to put this? Eric Larson likes to, he doesn't care who he offends. And he doesn't care if there's a mass orgy in the middle of his comic book. Doesn't care if there's nudity or sex acts going on, or even if there's some bad language. How does he deal with that in this? How does he deal with it in this book? Does he put that stuff in, or is it still too early to tell?
Here's the thing about this book, and part of the thinking behind Eric's Savage Dragon work is that he was told that his book was going to be rated adult, basically rated for mature. And at that point he said, well, if I'm going to be mature and I'm going to be in with the books that have full out nudity and sex scenes, I'm going to lean into that. This book is rated T for teen.
Okay.
So even though Hannah is in it and, you know, is again, very, very, pneumatic, for lack of a better word, Hannah is a very, very voluptuous young woman. And she's running around, you know, and it looks like 1994. She's got a ripped t-shirt and she's got cargo pants with a visible thong. It's something where this is definitely teen plus. It's like, we're going to tease you with characters with midriffs and low cut tops, but there's no actual nudity. And the violence is even, you know, as I said, I feel like this issue sort of hits you right in the face with violence in the way that Savage Dragon doesn't. But the violence is even shown to you in a way that feels more viewer friendly, if that makes sense.
I mean, yeah,
an impalement. Whereas in Savage Dragon, you'll see somebody's head fly across the room and gouts of blood. You won't necessarily see somebody, you know, ripping out other people's.
Okay, that's interesting. That's good that he can rein it in when he needs to rein it in.
All right, also, cool. Apparently, Spawn has a trench coat now, so he's officially a 90s hero.
How come those guys don't, how come there's not more? I always thought there'd be just tons of crossover once Image started and they all had their characters. And we met Max and we met Savage Dragon. And we had all these other characters and Jim Lee's whole lineup and everything. How come that didn't turn into like the way Marvel and DC do things where there's just tons of crossover all the time?
Well, in my estimation,
Jim Lee left. Rob Liefeld retired.
The thing that broke it, and this is the thing that really broke it, I feel, is that they had a shared universe for like the first 2 years or so. At one point, they actually, everybody swapped books and did issue 25 of somebody else's book and then left it for the creator to build to the issue 25 that they did. So like Jim Lee did issue 25 of Spawn and somebody had, you know, had to come back and build it. What really, I think, broke it was when Rob Liefeld kind of fell out. And I think it was, I can't remember now, Shattered Image was the name of the book. They had to actually write Liefeld's Youngblood characters out of the universe with a Crisis on Infinite Earth-style big crossover that basically broke away and said, these things no longer happened in the new continuity and those characters don't exist anymore. Bye.
Mm.
And I feel like having to do that or having done that, things kind of went to more of a an individual thing. Like if you read Invincible, Kirkman loves to have those people throw in there. He'll have, you know, Spawn show up. He'll have Witchblade show up. But they are completely out of continuity with the main books. It's just these are the characters as I want them to be in my book. So it's kind of like individual continuities that may share characters.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm really sort of fine with anyway, but
yeah, no, that's true.
Yep.
All right. Just curious. Always thought it was weird they didn't do more of that.
Yeah. Rob broke it.
Yep.
That's always the answer. Rob broke it.
All right.
okay. So here is kind of another comic from Image Comics. It's called Slumber from Tyler Burton and Vanessa Cardinelli. So imagine you're in the 1980s and you're a government force that is testing people's dreams and sending people into other people's dreams to assassinate them. And let's say that you made a movie out of it. That movie would be called Dream Warriors. In Slumber Number One, we have a character named Stetson who is able to enter people's dreams and kill other people's nightmares. So she calls herself a dream detective. So people come to her and say, oh, I keep having this nightmare of this clown coming up and a scary clown dream where he comes and chases me and then does horrible things to me. And so she's like, okay, step into this machine. We'll hook you up, go to sleep. And as soon as she goes to sleep, she walks through a door kind of like in Monsters, Inc. And then she steps into these people's dreams and she waits for the creepy killer clown to show up or the pedophile clown to show up and murders them. And then these people don't have these bad dreams anymore. So that's kind of the premise. But in Slumber Number One, what if there was something in people's dreams that was controlling them and having them go out and kill people? So imagine you go to sleep, you wake up in the next morning and you're in somebody else's house. You're covered in blood. There's a dead body there and you're the person who killed it. You have no recollection of this. You feel like your body has been taken over by somebody and the police need to figure out who it is. And Stetson, the dream hunter, the dream detective, needs to find out who this is. It may have something to do with her missing daughter. It is a trip of a book. I dig the story. I like the concept that Tyler Burton has created. Art is very specific to individual tastes. I'm not a huge fan of how Cardinelli draws in this issue. Things get a little crazy and that's fine. I would say that, I would liken her closest to, who's the guy that did Chew, the artist on Chew.
It
reminds me a lot of that, but the color palette is nothing close to that. Of course it's a dream world. So you're going to have very bright, vibrant pastel colors all over the place. But it's just not to my liking. That being said, I kind of want to find out how far down the rabbit hole, so to speak, this series goes, because one of the detectives who has been assigned all these murders wakes up in somebody else's house with a bunch of dead bodies around him. And oh no, this can't be good. So I really enjoyed this book. I'm just going to ding it a little bit just because of the my distaste for the art. Again, you probably will like it. It just was not to my liking. Still a very good book. Four Slices of Meatloaf for me. Go check it out this week. It's out this week from Image Comics. It's called Slumber. And if you're into what goes on in your nightmare world, it also kind of creeps me out because my son, my oldest son, sleepwalks and sleep talks like a lot. And so it's just like, I got to keep him away from sharp knives in the middle of the night so he doesn't come after somebody. So
good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. We have to double check, make sure all the doors are locked before we go to bed. All that fun stuff. So anyway, Rodrigo, you are ahead of everyone else, as always. And let's jump ahead to see what Mad Cave Studio has for us next week.
Next week, Speed Republic number 2 comes out. I reviewed Speed Republic number 1. If I had to do like an elevator pitch, what if the Hunger Games, but with cars? This is just pretty interesting. We are delving into some flashbacks because the main character and his estranged sister are now involved in this race across Europe. That is kind of put on by, I believe, a character literally straight up called the Autocrat. That is put on sort of as like a Circus Maximus kind of situation. There's some great panels in this where they're discussing sort of that, you know, everybody's watching the race. So people will like give, people will have drops, not in any sort of, what do I want to say? Not in any sort of like standardized way, right? Like I think in the Hunger Games, it's like people can like send in stuff to help like their particular person, but here people will just be like, hey, racers, there's something over here, and it's like one of them shows them like getting some weapons, like another one there's just like a snake in there, and then like yeah so it's like people will put this up, and it's like you don't know when you go to one because people are messed up, like you might open one and there's a snake or there's nothing useful and you just spend time getting out of your car and digging it up or whatever. So yeah, that's interesting. The sort of the main plot of this particular issue involves our protagonist meeting up with a friend and then kind of having a decision point of like, do I trust this person? Do I not trust this person? And if I trust them, what sort of consequences can this have? So it's interesting. I am enjoying it. The art is really good. You know, Emmanuel Aparascandolo can really draw cars, which is good. You know, I think showing it's funny because a lot of the it's like, what do cars do? Well, cars move, but they're also just boxes, right? Because like showing cars in motion and making it seem dynamic is actually weirdly challenging, right? Like you show two cars racing down a street in a comic, they just look like a pair of boxes sitting there. So angles, speed lines, all this other stuff kind of comes together, and the artist does a really good job of it. I'm going to give it 3.5 slices of meatloaf. I'm enjoying it. It's not necessarily 100% my jam, but I'm definitely curious to see where they take it.
Scott, how are you at drawing cars?
Terrible. It's really hard. Like everyone always talks about how hands are hard, or you know, eyes, or there's lots of, you know, artist hangups. Cars is like maybe number one. Cars are terrible to draw. Really hard. And people who can do it well, I have like nothing but massive amounts of respect for them.
All right. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. If Rodrigo says the cars look great and Scott says drawing cards is hard, then you know that Speed Republic might be a thing for you to go and check out. And if you're looking for more reviews, make sure you head over to the Major Spoilers website, where we have reviews showing up each and every day of the week. And if you'd like to keep this show going, just a reminder, we are basically fully funded through the support of our patrons over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoiler. So if you want to see this show continue, we've been doing this for like almost 15 years now just for this show. If you want to see it continue another 15 years, then how about you help us out? Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. If you can afford like $5 a month, we would really appreciate it. Find out more, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Okay, Scott, over the last couple of years, I have been, I don't know, torturing. Torturing is probably not the right word. I go into it with good intentions that we're going to go in and we're going to read some newspaper strips. Maybe it's Amazing Spider-Man. Maybe it's, I can't even remember, Flash Gordon. You know, all these things that people are like, oh, these were the greatest newspaper strips of all time. And each and every time, there's just something about them that just doesn't work in modern reading. This week, one of our fine patrons, this is one of the other benefits of being a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers, said, hey, I think you guys would really get a kick out of Rip Kirby. And I said, okay, let's try this. So this week we are taking a look at three different Rip Kirby stories. And we're going to do this a little differently. I've tasked each one of our panelists with reading one of these stories, and they're going to talk about it. And anybody else can jump in. I'm going to ask questions. Other people are going to ask questions. And we're going to see if Rip Kirby holds up. And we're going to shine the spotlight first on you, Rodrigo, because you had the privilege of reading the very first Rip Kirby story.
Oh.
Ever. 1944, I guess. Yeah, 1944, yeah. 1946, something like that.
Okay, sure. So I read Rip Kirby, The Chip Faraday Murder,
dun, dun, dun.
which just immediately was a problem for me because I think Chip Faraday is a much better detective name than Rip Kirby.
Yes.
But in fact, Chip Faraday is the victim, and it's a lady. And so the initiating incident is Rip Kirby hears a knock on the door. And he's like, oh, I'm going to check that out. And then here's a gunshot. And he's like, oh, no. Opens the door, and a dame just drops dead right in his arms. So that throws some suspicion of him on him. The cops show up. He asks around in his building to see if anybody heard anything. And some clues kind of come up, some clues that are going to keep sort of resurfacing throughout this. He teams up with a reporter who is a pretty lady named Honey.
Is she a reporter?
Isn't she?
I don't know, because here's the thing. If she's a reporter here, she doesn't stay a reporter for very long, because by the time we get later into these stories, she's like a fashion model.
Well, so, she becomes a fashion model in this.
Okay. Yeah.
So maybe
this is her career-changing moment.
Yeah. So it turns out Chip Faraday is a fashion model. And so Honey goes in. I think her first name is Honey.
Yeah,
I Honey forget because
her. Yeah, Honey Dorian.
Yeah, yeah. So she goes in. I want to like undercover 17 question marks because Rip shows up with her at the agency and is like, "Hey, can you give Honey a job?" And they're like, "Sure." She's very attractive. So it's like at no point. Is there any sign of like, oh, we're going to sneak her in and see if she can like pretend to be someone else and get some information? It's just like, here's clearly like Rip Kirby's plant in the office trying to figure things out. So that's cool. So this all develops. Lots of characters come up, lots of potential suspects. In the end, we figure out why she died and also why. Some other people end up dying on the way there. Honey almost gets some acid thrown at her, or rather, she almost puts on some acid on her face by accident, or because somebody did a switcheroo with her lotion bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think too much about how that would have worked. And then by the end, everything falls into place. Blabber's gonna blab. We put it together, Rip figures it out, and we figure out who the killer is.
Dun, dun, dun. And there's a dun, bunch dun, of dun. Other murders, too. I mean, here we are in 1946, and There's like heroin use in this comic.
Yes.
Like, they literally go into an office and Rip is like, here's a needle with drugs. I suspect drugs are behind this. And like, there's a big gambler boss man that's into drug, you know, the dealing the drugs to everybody. It's, I was really surprised that they were like, oh yeah, let's just use a heroin or, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think it's coke, but let's use heroin and speedballs in this book.
It's like, yeah, this character is a drug addict. That's just one of the things that they are. And they're still like relatively functional. Whereas like one of the things that people know about them is that they're doing some sort of opiate.
Mm-hmm.
It's very off-putting because ever since, I'm guessing, the DARE program exploded in all of our faces, it's very rare to see casual or, I mean, potentially even positive drug users. Not that there's like any positive use of drugs in this.
Right.
But yeah, I was very surprised at seeing drug use, in fact, be important. But also, it's funny because they just refer to it as drugs. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, he was using his drugs. Oh, he's high on drugs.
Yeah.
Those strange drugs. It's like they never say what it is.
Yeah.
Maybe as a way to stay relevant. So, you know, here we are in 2022. We don't know what it is. It could be meth.
Smack. Speedball.
Yeah.
Okay. Here is something I want, ever since we're in this very first story, I want everybody to weigh in on the art, because the art is very consistent. I think the artist worked on, I don't know if it's the same artist in the first one of this first story as it is in the last story that I think Scott read, but the art is super consistent. And in my opinion, the art is fan-freaking-tastic.
Phenomenal. Absolutely.
In this stuff for a newspaper strip. Yeah. Scott, what do you think? What do you think of good old Rip Kirby?
Couldn't have agreed more with the art. The art is amazing. It's both of a time and also just technically proficient in any time. Like, it's just really nice. And we're talking about black and white inks here. That's tricky to do when you're trying to build a city backdrop and him walking around. Like, there's a whole scene in mine where in the issues I read where he's, you know, out on the street and you have to create a whole lot of sort of city milieu with very few lines. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of blacks, and it's good. It's very, very good. Like,
and how would you guys describe Rip Kirby? Because I would say, imagine George Reeves as Superman, as Clark Kent.
Yeah.
But maybe a little bit more chiseled, not as barrel chested, but definitely a Clark Kentish, husky, good looking guy kind of vibe.
Going. I was kind of getting him as kind of nebbishy. He's not as wiry as like the professor on the Gilligan's Island.
Yeah.
But I always get that kind of vibe from him.
Yeah, because you know, he's an author, he's Johnson a scientist, sort of he's an amateur detective. He does it all, baby.
Yeah.
He wears
spectacles.
He's also probably 25 in this book, but he looks like he's 85 just in the way that, you know, back in the day,
everyone who was
like 30 was older. Yeah.
It's like we think of grandpas as dressing this way with their big glasses and pipe.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to hear Rodrigo mention Honey's current or her origin, because she is a fashion model in the one I read.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess they were like, you know what? She like this, it would just be like we can probably put her in cuter outfits if we just say that she's a model.
And
her first outfit that she shows up in, she looks like Stan Marsh from South Park. That's basically ladies like pretty lady Stan Marsh.
Yeah. Yep. I hate to say it, but yeah, you're right.
But she doesn't stay that way for very long, because there are many times throughout all these books where Honey is in like negligee, you know, evening sleepwear type stuff. And it's like, oh, you can see the thigh high stockings on this. This is, I guess, pretty acceptable in 1946 newspapers. So from that aspect, I just dug this art just from the moment I first saw it. I was like, oh, my God, this stuff is fantastic. The thing that struck me about this first story, and Scott, you may want to go back and read this. After reading this, I could swear that this was a Johnny Dollar story.
Oh, very much, yeah.
Just in the fact that when we find out who done it, how it was done, all this stuff, I was like, I'm pretty sure I heard this on one of the Johnny Dollar shows from like 8 months ago. So for that, I was like, if this is what we're in for, then I'm totally down for reading some more Rip Kirby, which I did, because I then jumped into issue number 8 or story number 8. Terror on the Thames, which Matthew, I'm sorry that I assigned this one to you, because this one is probably the most convoluted, dumbest story in the whole trilogy of the three that we read, or that I read. Mm-hmm. This one is the weakest one. I mean, the art is still phenomenal, don't get me wrong. The structure of the plot, or the gimmick of the plot, is good, but the execution, mm-hmm, I think, is just really poor. So run us through Terror on the Thames.
Terror on the Thames, I believe is how it's pronounced, from, you know, Benny Hill shows when I was a kid. The thing about Terror on the Thames that I really love is that, like so many good mysteries of my youth, it all really wedges, it hinges on this completely ridiculous, unbelievable, convoluted twist. But Terror on the Thames actually begins with a group of models in Britain, and Rip, for some reason, traveling with them through London. And one of them is Elizabeth Bannister, known to her friends as Betya, because if you bet her anything, Betya will bet you that she can win. So Betya goes out, and she's told that she can't go out at night, and she spend any time with her beau, Carlo, and she's like, betcha I can. She goes out, decides to take a swim in the River Thames, and disappears. Body washes up. Like, oh no, there's a body washing up in Betya's swimsuit. But Rip is a super smart man, and he starts putting clues together. And you're right, Stephen. There is a really stupid moment about halfway through.
Yeah, because halfway through, they're like, let's rewind 32 hours and find out that, no, she didn't die. She didn't drown. She was picked up by some sex traffickers and then sold into gambling. And I don't know what else goes on. This story is like so messed up.
They aren't overtly sex traffickers. They're just people.
What are they then? Because there's a girl already on the boat that they help escape, mm-hmm, and it's implied that she's there for, like, quote unquote, this would be 1948, quote unquote, companionship.
Yes. Definitely there's seriousness going on there. And that girl ends up having been a dancer who supposedly was hired by this elderly rich man to be a companion, which, you know, I think it's the same in code in 48 it is in 2022. The part where it gets horrible is the fact that guy throws her she can't swim.
Yeah.
And the girl who is presumably dead can swim and is a very strong swimmer, which is actually one of the clues that Rips comes into. But by the end of the story, the old guy, the Cormorant, Captain Cormorant, who's the man actually responsible for all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Somehow Betya is like, oh no, he's a sweet and kind man. And I'm like,
okay. Maybe I couldn't understand why she felt that way, because he runs like a gambling boat and she's, mm-hmm, she's totally into gambling. We find out that she's got money debts because she gambles too hard. But yeah, she kind of falls for this old guy who's like, yeah, I don't know if this is Stockholm syndrome or what, but she's totally down with doing whatever this guy wants.
He does end up getting possibly fatally wounded, saving her from a thug in the employ of someone in his employ. And the implication that I keep getting through that last third of the story is that Cormorant didn't necessarily know all the terrible things that his scar-faced evil thug was doing. I liked this as, you know, a 1940s weird story where, mm-hmm, you get to a point. I always liked it when Columbo would start the story where we'd see the murder.
Yeah,
we'd know what happened. We know who the murderer is. And the point is, how are they going to unravel it?
Mm-hmm.
So the first half of this story where Rip is like, well, she's probably dead, but this seems a little bit odd. And hey, have you guys noticed that this corpse has pierced ears, but Betya doesn't?
Yeah, so the problem I have, so I don't mind with the whole, you know, we're going to take a swerve and we're going to go and see what really happened. But, mm-hmm, if you're reading this day to day, there's literally like 10 weeks worth of, probably not 10 weeks, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's probably 5 or 6 weeks of, let's just follow Betya on this boat and do all this stuff before we ever see Rip Kirby ever again, when he's like, hey, did you know that this dame has pierced earrings? And I'm like, oh, man, yeah, finally.
Hey. Well, and there's three strips a page.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 50 pages, so 150 total strips. Did it run 7 days a week,
or ran,
was it a Monday, Wednesday, Friday?
I think this ran every single day. Let me look and see if I could see.
Did they do any Sunday color stuff? I wonder.
No, if well, if they did, it's not collected in, it's in not this collected volume that in. We had. Yeah.
Yeah.
Traditionally, at that point, I would think that the Sunday strips would be separate.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, in the 40s, because they would do that when we were collecting the, what was that mess that we read?
Phantom. Flash Gordon. Oh, Phantom.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you'd have that Sunday strip pop up and it would be like, mm-hmm. Oh.
I can't see what this is. I'm going to guess that this is a Monday, Wednesday, Friday. No, I'm going to bet this is daily. I'm going to bet this is daily. Because this was a, according to what I'm reading here, that King Features really promoted this comic. Mm-hmm. So if they were really promoting it, I'm going to bet it had to have been daily. So let's you got 150 strips.
From June 14th, 48 to December 4th, 48.
Yeah, so six months.
That is 6 months, 150 strips. Let's see, carry the one.
Yeah, well, that's 30 weeks. Yep. So,
that's,
yeah,
that's 53 strips a day or.
Yeah, so, 10, but my whole point is you're spending 2 months, literally 2 months just following Bet Year Round. So that's why I did not care for this story. Although I did discover that I think Rip Kirby is really secretly Bruce Wayne.
Could be.
I mean, think about it. I mean, sure. He's wealthy. He's mm-hmm. super smart. He's a gad about town. He's got a butler. He's got a Silver St. Cloud that he runs around with, even though he doesn't marry her. I'm pretty sure Rip Kirby is Bruce Wayne. The only thing that's missing is a tragic story where his parents are murdered.
I believe that Rip Kirby may actually be Lamont Cranston. But more importantly, I think the thing that is interesting about Rip Kirby for me is throughout this, you know, we have, as you mentioned, there are, you know, lingerie scenes and mm-hmm. there's the models dressing. And of course, there's lots of scenes of the main character in her incredibly skimpy bathing suit. It only covers like 60-70% of her body. You can see her ankles, boys. But you do also have this thing where throughout it, Kirby is perfectly happy in a monogamous relationship and sending out his little, you know, his mm-hmm. butler associate to get his head caved in. Yeah. I mean, they beat up his associate.
Yeah, yeah, his butler.
And I'm
yeah.
just like, this is so neat to see this because he does remind me, kind of wandering around bits and pieces of like a Clark Kent character,
mm-hmm.
but he never does the heroic moment of I'm now going to step in and save all the day. It's the other people around him. You know, the scrawny butler gets a hero moment, and yeah, he also has a cool bathing suit.
And in mine, he gets beat up, like somebody just conks him out, and then the chief of police finds him, or the main detective, and just roasts him.
Yeah,
like he just sits there and makes fun of him, and then is like, "Well, I'm going to tell the other cops about this," and they kind of end up figuring out a way for him not to tell everyone. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, that is not what I expected from this, like, very clear, like, look at how cool this character is and everything he knows how to do. I was surprised that not only does he get beat up, but that then they, you know, go on and make fun of him for it.
The other thing that's really stand out about this Tara on the Thames is the facial work, the character work mm-hmm. that's here, because everybody has a very distinct face. It's not like you see a double up of characters. You know, the scrimy guy looks scrimy. The drunkard looks like a drunkard. The chief of Scotland Yard looks very British of Scotland Yard. There's fat people, there's thin people, there's dumb people, there's smart people. And he just does a fantastic job of doing this.
Well, and sure, you know, this one is drawn by Alex Raymond, and Raymond mm-hmm. was the creator of Flash Gordon. So by 48, he's been doing a daily strip for 25 years. What's amazing to me is we have a sequence early in the beginning where the fashion models, six or seven fashion models pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do they all have their cute little outfits, each of them is a different height. Mm-hmm. They have slightly different body proportions. Each of them has a unique face. It's not six of the same woman. It's six individual characters. Yeah. And that's, Yeah, and they're really minor characters too. They don't have much to do other than, you know, gossip about Betya in that first third of the story, but they're all so fully realized.
Yep.
It makes you wonder how much work he put into this strip.
I don't know, because the night scenes are fantastic with the contrast. The foggy scenes of good old foggy London looks like foggy London. It's really good. So while I don't care for the story because of the way it's drawn out, and it's the longest story of the three that we're reading, the art is just, you gotta pick up this volume just so you can check out the fantastic art in this.
Absolutely. So,
all right, Scott, it's down to you. You now have the final story, which is 0 Hour, not that 0 Hour.
No,
a future Rip Kirby comes back and says, look out for Hawk. And then they decide to change it to somebody else at the end.
Yeah, the 0 is actually a reference to the villain of the run I read. There's a lady who's called Frau Zero. They don't really ever say her first name, I don't think. But her and what I think is supposed to be her husband, although it's not entirely
companion.
Yeah, it's weird. And his mustache is weird. But anyway, they're evil and they have some deep, dark plans to rob a bank. And the whole thing starts with Honey, who's it's somewhere in Europe. I think Paris. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Paris. And she's doing a line that is very specific to these people. I guess these 0 people make clothes. That's a weird conceit, but whatever. She goes home and she's charged with taking the dress, one of these special dresses she wore with a special rose on it. And her job is to take that home and deliver it for them. And they're going to go by plane. She's going to go by boat. And by boat, I mean like luxury, fancy boat. And so, you know, that's how it starts. Turns out there's a little microfilm in a tiny canister inside of that rose. And, you know, during her time on the boat, she decides to have a little night out and wears the dress, even though she shouldn't. And then the rose falls off or gets, oh no, she spilled stain. Spilled coffee on it. And then she thought she'd swap it out with a different rose. And so by the time she gets home, they find out their rose is missing, which has their little canister in it. And in the canister is this microfilm that is just a map of like where they're going to go to break into the bank. And it's mostly just an above street map. But there's this whole thing about how they, you know, they're going to tunnel inside and get into the bank. Anyway, because this is Honey and her boyfriend is Skip, Flip, Dip, Whip, whatever his name is. What's his name?
Rip Kirby.
He's on the case and he thinks something fishy going on. So all that stuff starts happening there. I was struck with a weird feeling while reading this. So I had a blast, by the way, reading it. I really enjoyed the whole thing. And the whole thing is just about him uncovering this bank robbery and busting the zeros. And, you know, nobody gets killed. They all go to jail. But the thing that struck me is the weekly format, or excuse me, the daily format is so interesting. Because when there's a comic every day and you have 3 panels to work with, and that's pretty much exclusively all he works in here is 3 panels. You have so much you can say and so much space to do it in. And cliffhangers are weird because it's only a day, you know? So you're not really cliffhanging all that hard, but also the lady at the end said something, things will work out perfectly. And then you're like, oh, all right, well, let's get to the next one. And I found myself getting into what the rhythm must have been like for these kind of drama strips back in the day. Because I was never into like any of that when I was growing up, like what would have been.
So probably we most recently, well, maybe not most recently, but we read the Amazing Spider-Man strips.
Oh, yeah. That
and the problem with that was the first panel was let's recap what just happened. Then there'd be maybe a panel, maybe 2 panels of actual action. Then you would end up with your cliffhanger. And then the next one, very next one would be, OK, let's tell you what just happened. One thing of action and then one other thing that's your cliffhanger that then gets repeated. And that was incredibly frustrating to read in Amazing Spider-Man. But here and especially in 0 Hour. They don't really do any of that.
No, they don't. And they, it's really odd. It's such Johnny Dollar, like you mentioned earlier. It's impossible not to be sort of charmed and you know, enjoy it from this weird many decade difference or distance from what used to be considered dramatic daily entertainment. but I really, really had a fun time with it. And I saw everything coming before it got there. And I knew who was in trouble and when.
Yeah.
And I knew how it was all going to end up. So it's not like they were surprising me with any of those things. Like none of that was ever on the table. But what was on the table was some fun pacing, getting into that rhythm of a daily strip, which I've never really done outside of, you know, funny strips or comic strips, which usually don't have continuity. So that's just a weird art form, you know, to sort of explore, I guess, a bit here. And then the art really sells it. I'm bummed to hear it only ever lasted six months. It seemed like something that should have.
Oh, no. And this series ran from 1948 until 1999.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it ran for like 40 years.
Okay, I thought it was a short run. That's interesting because all my copyright King feature stuff on here says 59. So I think mine must have been later.
Yeah, yours is 56 at least in the 56. Panel that I'm looking at because Rip's driving around in a Mercedes Gullwing and it's like, ooh, Mr. Fancy Pants.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like there's a point where she's on the boat and they've got people watching her make sure she's staying out of trouble. And there's this great line where this guy with a mustache and a really bad comb over comes over to her while she's playing shuffleboard on the deck of the ship. And she's like, could I steady you in case the ship rolls again, Miss Dorian? Thank you, Mr. Billings, but I'd rather practice rock and roll to be in step when I get home. Like, it's just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. People hitting on her left and right.
Yeah, constantly. And, yeah. But there's a charm to this. And mostly what I was blown away by was just the technicality of the art and how good it is. I love art that looks detailed and intricate from far away. And when you zoom in, you realize it's a lot of quick lines. It's just very, very cool. It's something I kind of aspire to do. And I really liked it.
There's some of them, yeah. I guess when I look at the black and white, sometimes, especially in the story that you did, there's times where it's just like, oh, you can tell that they're not even, maybe they drew the shape of the head or maybe the, you know, the clothing or whatever. But if you just look at it, it's like, those aren't really lines. Those are just areas of black that create the form of the dress or the coat or the hat or whatever they're wearing. And it's just like, yeah, they know what they're doing. I'm sure that they've penciled it, but it just feels like, you know, there's no lines to these characters. It's all just these areas of void and black.
Oh yeah, totally. And it's really, that's something where they were always teaching us in art school and everybody always talks about is like, you know, line economy. Where are you putting your lines? Where are you doing it? How are you balancing out those compositions? This just looks effortless. So from an artist standpoint, it's embarrassingly good. It's really, really good. I'm sure he did not get paid enough for this job is what I'm guessing.
Probably not. Because one of the artists worked on it for 40 years. Let me see.
Raymond died in 56.
Yeah, in 56. So Raymond did it for 10 years. And then John Prentice came in and did it for the remaining 40 years. Yeah.
There was a chunk in there that was done by Al Williamson, who I remember from early issues of Star Wars, who was just amazing. But yeah, which one did Scott do? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
He did the one that's called Zero Hour, because you've got these two people posing as, I don't know, I think they were supposed to be German in France, but they were trying to, like I said, trying to get this microfilm so they could. Yeah. I wanted to look because it was really funny. They talk about New York, but they also say, oh, the where this crime is taking place is in the city of Manopolis.
Manopolis.
And the chief of police is named Chief Kirby, but he doesn't look anything like Jack Kirby. So
chief or pink Kirby. Nintendo Kirby either.
He's not eating everything.
Apparently Zero Hour is the last volume that was entirely done by Raymond before he died.
And this is just great. This is really great. So I'm curious, now that you guys have each had a chance to read your own story and listen to everybody else talk about the stories that they read, do you think that Rip Kirby is a success compared to some of the other ones that we've read? Or is this something that you're just like, nah, this is just another newspaper strip. Let's get on to something else.
I mean, I would say it is successful. Definitely it's successful to read this way. Because, yeah, it doesn't spend a lot of time doing recaps, right? I think there were maybe, in my whole thing, there were probably one or two overt, this is everybody, and this is what they're doing recaps. And, you know, mostly it was just like, you know, is like, oh, we need to do this because of that murder of this person that we're investigating. Just super quick, you know, dialogue recaps. So put all together, this story actually flows pretty well. It's like you actually get more panels than a comic book. This is like, I don't know. Yeah, you just get more space to do things. And it's, you know, it's actually every strip tends to be pretty interesting, at least to look at.
Yeah. What about you, Matthew?
I think that for me, this is one of those things where a lot of times when we've read through these, especially the ones that are serialized, they've been sort of overwritten. You know, as you pointed out, it's like, hey, we get to the beginning of the strip. They're like, remember last week? And then the middle is something. And then the end is, and here's where we're going to give you the cliffhanger so that the next time you come around, hey, remember yesterday? It's the same cliffhanger. This doesn't happen in Rip Kirby. This feels like a very much an artist strip where he's just like, yep, okay, I know where we need to go. I'm just going to draw some stuff. And if people can't keep up, they can, you know, go back and spend a dime to get yesterday's newspaper because that's what's going to happen. And I feel like as a complete story, Terror on the Thames is probably my favorite of any of the syndicated strip comic strip collections we've ever covered in the show. Now, I did not read the other two, mostly because my life is, you know, basically being fired out of a cannon right now, but I feel like I want to go read them. I've actually downloaded them for a point when I have a minute to sit and read just because of how much I enjoyed what you call the worst strip of the collection.
I mean, it's so of the three that we read, this is this is definitely the worst one, in my opinion.
I feel like I may have to go look up some Rip Kirby.
There's the chapter seven or the seventh story in the series, Bleak Prospects, is 210 strips long. So yeah, it may be even worse. The Chip Faraday murder was 43 strips. That was Rodrigo's. And then Zero Hour is 60 strips long. So, you know, those are fairly short. Maybe that's a thing if it just gets too drawn out. So I don't know. We'll have to look at these. These stories are scattered through the first four volumes of the Rip Kirby collection that IDW has. If you want to go and pick those up or track those down, if you're looking for the hardcovers, which might be the best place to get these, some of the early ones are really expensive. As I'm looking right now, it looks like IDW has released 11 volumes of this. I don't know if they still have the rights to produce these. I haven't seen anything from them in a while that has promoted Rip Kirby. And there's probably easily another 11 volumes that they could continue in this. But part of the problem is when you're doing these collections is that there's a very limited interest, I think, for people to go and collect these old newspaper strips. So maybe that may be one of the reasons why we don't see so much of that anymore. Scott, what are your final thoughts on Rip Kirby?
It made me want to read more of it. I think when I was a kid, I didn't like that stuff because I was like, I don't want to read serious stuff in here. I don't want to read, you know, these real people in their lives or whatever, however I perceived it. And this would have still been running when I was a teen or younger.
Yeah. 99 all the way up through college, man. Up that until really just before. Me. I mean, your kids were born whenever Rip Kirby was still in the newspaper.
My first was in 94. They still had 6 good years of that strip left, or 5, I guess. That's a really weird feeling. But I don't know. I liked, because I do like OTR. I like old time radio, and I like to just put stuff on and listen. Mm-hmm. And I love Johnny Dollar, and I love, like, oh, there's so many. I can't even name them all. And I can just have those on in the background, and there's just something about them, that vintage thing. And this gave me some of that. And I don't know what I was expecting, but that's what I came away with, and I really had a good time with it. So right, I wouldn't mind more reading a collection of sorts.
Yeah. Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us again this month. Tell people where they can find you and all the other cool things that you are currently doing.
Sure. All kinds of show stuff and art stuff. Speaking of art, there's plenty of that to be found there as well. All people have to do is go to frogpants.com and check it out. And speaking of vintage, if you've got any listeners that are like, man, I sure love retro gaming. I love old games back when they were hard and you liked it or whatever. Whatever your reasons for liking old games are. I have a whole new show called Play Retro with my buddy Brian Dunaway, where we cover this sort of stuff. And today we hit on everything about Metroid as an example. We talked about Joust for an entire episode. So we're kind of all over the place. But if you're into retro gaming, it might be one to check out. It's called Play Retro And you can get it wherever you get your shows.
If you ever do one on Dragon's Lair, let me know, because I got a story to tell you. It might be good to have you on there.
100% we'll be doing that, and I will take you up on that, because that is coming for sure. That thing holds a weird place in history.
All right.
We got to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Scott. And thank you, dear listeners. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you for being a listener. Currently, our show is entirely funded by you, our patrons. So thank you so much to those of you who are backing our show.
And if you say to yourself, how do I become one of those awesome people? If you want to help support Major Spoilers, you can go right now to patreon.com/Major Spoilers. You can sign up for a silver level membership right now.
You can also support us by using the affiliate links, and you can find those at majorspoilers.com.
We will be back next week. Look to the skies. We may be doing this as a live stream next week. General chat, AMA, I don't know. Why are we going to do it? Well, because we know that you love comics. We do too. We'll talk with you soon. Bye now.
Fat the X-ray vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, he kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Star Raven, it's like a man of iron. I might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2022 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.